Okay, so to kind of get started tonight, most of you guys should know that the title of the talk for tonight is called When the Hard Happens. And I think all of us know that the world that we live in is a broken world. And especially, I mean, after this past weekend, the reality is that, I mean, suffering, if it hasn't happened yet, it's coming. And these two ladies tonight, we have Beverly Ficken and Tiffany Moody speaking and sharing their stories with us. I met Beverly probably a long time ago now when I taught her daughter at Wesleyan. And then I met Tiffany this past spring when we ran the Tough Mudder together. And I knew she was strong right when we started working out together. But so they both have been through a lot, and they're also, they both make me laugh. And I think that all of you and me will learn a lot from them sharing their stories. So I just wanted to introduce both of them. Tiffany was actually going to be celebrating her 17th wedding anniversary with Patrick this upcoming week and has been at Perimeter Church for about that long. She went to Norcross, which I didn't know. She went to Auburn and played soccer there, and they currently live in Johns Creek. She's been a stay-at-home mom for 14 years and was in marketing before that. She's passionate about orphans, foster kids, fighting childhood cancer. She loves to do all things athletic, to write, read. And now since she's a mom, her favorite hobby is sleeping, which I'm like, I think everyone can agree with that. And then she also has a blog that's called Leaving It All on the Field, which is awesome. So, and you'll get to hear more about that. And then Beverly has been a member of Perimeter Church for 12 years. She has no blog, she said. Her family moved to Atlanta after living in Tampa, Montgomery, and Birmingham. She's been married to David for 27 years, and they have 3 kids. She was a stay-at-home mom for 16 years before she returned to high school and middle school as a math teacher, and she currently teaches. And she has a passion for the souls of teenagers. She's a devoted advocate of adoption, loves her sofa anytime she can climb on it and do nothing. So anyway, but I'm so thankful that you guys are speaking tonight, and welcome them up.
Are we doing this now?
Huh?
You want your water?
No, I'm good.
Okay. Hi, I'm Beverly, and that's Tiffany. And I think we're just going to start by sharing a little bit of our stories with you. Some of you know it, and some of you know it very well. But just as briefly as we can, kind of give you a little bit of background. And I think that Tiffany and I both agree that we feel a little weird doing this because even though, yes, we've been through struggles, we know that every single human alive has been through struggles. And so I think we kind of view this as a time that we can maybe learn and share with each other a little bit, because I think that we all have met God in those struggles. And the more that we can share with each other about who He is to us in those tough times, the more that we get to see our Father. And so anyway, this is my family that they're showing you up there. My husband is obviously the one on the right. The cute, lanky boy is my son. The oldest is my daughter, Neely, who I will briefly mention. And in front of me is Lilia, my youngest. She's 11. So I will just start by telling you a little bit of a story. And I'm going to start with Once Upon a Time because I like fairy tales. So I will tell you that once upon a time, there was a little girl. And she had 3 passions. And those passions were reading books, babies. She was pregnant many times before she was 10 with the pillow from her mother's sofa. And she wanted to be princess of the universe. And then when she figured out from an article that there might be something bigger than the universe, she would tell her friends that she was princess of that too. But they could be princess of everything that was left. And that was how I played pretend with my friends. I was in charge. So that was my passions. And I was probably the most passionate about books and babies from a very, very young age. And I would tell you that I also had 3 fears, and those 3 fears were roaches, who I stayed very, very far away from, tornadoes, which I laughed at as I came into the meeting tonight. I'm like, okay, we're going to meet another one, and cancer. I had an uncle, a great uncle, that died when I was about 7, and I remember seeing him at Christmas one year, and he was kind of a Santa Claus, very jolly, ruddy-cheeked, and just a pod piper with children. And I saw him one Christmas, and he scooped me up in his big old arms and threw me over his head. And then by the next Christmas, he was frail and stooped and could barely speak to me and tried to pretend to be jolly again. And the man that I knew wasn't there, and it terrified me. So I would sit, and y'all are going to think I needed counseling, and I probably did, probably still do, but I would sit by the window at my parents' house, and whenever it rained, it would get a little bit smoky and fogged up. I would draw crosses on the window, and I would pray that Jesus would use that symbol. I read too many books. Use that symbol to protect our house from cancer. So I grew up wanting to be a doctor because I was going to cure all of them. Now we know that's probably not ever going to happen to cure all of them at once, but I was going to cure them all at once. And so I had this great fear and I had this great passion. So the little girl grew up and she married the handsome prince that she met when she was 15, and everything was rocking along just nice. And they got married, and he asked her to marry him, and he said, "What do you want more than anything in the world?" Right before he was going to get down on his knee. And I said, "I want a baby," which was a weird comment for a man who was asking you to marry him. He didn't really know what to do with me at that point. He was kind of like, "Oh, really? That's nice. Now can we get back to me?" And so, you know, that was kind of like my mindset pretty much my whole life. And so we got married a couple years later. We decided to have a baby one weekend. We're like, let's try to have a baby. And so the very next weekend, my husband was out of town, and I prayed on my, I don't know what I was overcome, but I was overcome with a desire to pray for patience. So I decided to pray for patience, and I remember being on my knees in my bedroom by myself, like begging God to make me a patient woman. And that day, I'd gone on an errand, and I was coming back, and I had a very, very, very serious car accident, the kind that they medevac you to the hospital, and, you know, ears are falling. Anyway, we won't go into biological, like, goriness, but anyway, it was just not a pretty sight. And I almost died a couple of times over the next 10 days, and I stayed in the hospital about 4 weeks, and probably took me 3 months to where I could go back to work with a walker, and, you know, I'm young 20s, and so that was kind of very hard for me, you know, just, I didn't do anything wrong in the accident, and I think if I had done something wrong, it would have helped me, because I could have gone forward and say, oh, if I just don't do that again, then this bad thing won't happen, and I won't have all this pain, and I won't have lost organs, and I won't, you know, just, I could just keep going that way. But I didn't do anything wrong, and so it really shook me to the core, because I realized it might happen again the very next day, you know, and it might happen the very next day. And so I kept looking for things that I could not do, and nothing would work, and I just was like, it just overwhelmed me with that I wasn't in control. And I think we all know that, but we don't know that, and I wasn't in control, and there was nothing I could do to really be in control, and it really shook me to my foundations. And so at that point, we had, like I said, we wanted this baby so badly, and what I didn't realize was that day on that, during that wreck, that I'd pretty much lost the ability to bear children without a lot of medical help. Nothing was normal chemically in my body again. And so we began to pray that God would work a miracle, you know, like, you know, pray and pray and pray. And I remember that I would just, it's the roller coaster. For those of you who have gone through infertility, you know, the hope and the crash and the hope and the crash and the hope and the crash. And then your nephews are being born, and then your nieces are being born, and then you go to baby showers all day long, and you just, and you're trying to be happy. And the same time you're thinking, why not me? What have I done wrong? What have I done wrong? Why is that teenage girl pregnant? Why is she, you know, and nothing made sense, and it didn't add up to me. And I just thought maybe God had missed something good I had done, or did he not see that was a teenage girl, and what's the deal, and why the wreck? And I really got to the point that I knew I wasn't in control, but I wasn't necessarily so happy about it anymore. And so 7 years pass, and we don't have children. And I will tell you that I was riding in the car one day going to work, and I had on the Catholic channel, which had these little, like, I don't know why I never listened to it, but I had on the Catholic channel, they have all these little, somebody Catholic, help me, Jackie, these little, ba-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da, and they sing, y'all help me. I'm so sorry, it's probably something so holy, and I just totally made fun of the whole thing, and I don't mean to, but it's like some chant. So it was Mary's song, and they put it in a chant, and it was, you know, behold the handmaiden of the Lord, be it done to me according to your word. And it pierced me. And I remember thinking, okay, that's what I'm supposed to be doing here. And like I said, it's probably 5 years into the process at this point. And I just remember being shaken with, I'm supposed to be used by him. I'm not supposed to be using him to get what I want, because I've done it all really well, or like I thought I had, you know. So that was probably a huge moment for me, I went to work not free of the sadness, but free, really free. And that became a mantra. And so I think as I talk, just as we both talk tonight, I have mantras that are in my head and they're verses. And I just have to say them over and over and over to myself when things are not the way that I thought they should be. And that's one of mine. Behold the handmaid of the Lord, be it done to me according to thy word. Behold the handmaid of the Lord, be it done to me according to thy word. You know, because it's all so often about my word, you know. So anyway, so we went through and we finally got this beautiful call that said that we were able to adopt this beautiful domestic little tiny Neely baby girl. And it was an exciting day. We were called the day she was born. And we went down there and we were not allowed to see her. And we thought the birth mother had changed her mind and that we were going to turn back around and go home. But it turns out she had a very serious heart condition. And so we sat in front of the doctor and the doctor said, "Are you sure you want this one?" And we were like, "Well, yeah, we think we've been waiting for this call, and yeah, we think this is her, and you know, she's probably going to die, because you know, most of these kids that have this condition also have kidney and they have liver, and we don't know what's wrong with her yet. Why don't you just go back and wait for the next one?" He looks at the social worker and he's like, "You'll put him to the top of the list, right?" And she's like, "Well, we'll try. You know, the birth mother's shoes now, and we'll try to do what we can." And but my husband and I just really felt like she was our kid. And when we looked at him and we were like, you know, if we had had this child in the hospital and she had this condition, we would deal with it, you know, and she's our kid. And yes, we want her. So, you know, two open heart surgeries later and all of that, it works out. And she's still, you know, very healthy, considering it very healthy. But I remember we pulled over on the side of the road. We had Christian music on. And my husband and I both just, we were driving to where we were staying and we bawled like babies, because I think we both just felt betrayed again by God. We were like, you know, okay, really? 1 week we pray for patience, we have to go through 7 years of infertility, and now we're gonna get the baby that finally got the call, and 2 days later we're gonna face that you might let this one die. Is this really the plan? And I think I felt very betrayed and very are you really on my side? And I know you're in control, I got that, but I'm not, and I'm really pretty sure that I had a nicer plan, and this feels really mean, and I'm not so sure that I think you might be giggling a little bit when you do stuff to me, and that's how it felt, do stuff to me, and it really was a bad place with God, and I would say that lasted for years, and I would say the Psalms brought me to some truth in that, and the Psalms have meant so much. I don't know if the Psalms, I hated the Psalms before I was a Christian. I thought they were so boring. There's no story. But the Psalms to me, I'm sure any of you who've been through something, if you've leaned on the Psalms, it's like David's not a nice, cute story that ends up nice. Mm-hmm. He has struggle over and over and over, and he thinks it's getting better, and then it gets bad again, and he thinks it, and that's life. And David gets it, and he still was a man after God's own heart, and he gets it. And if you need sustenance in a time of struggle, I tell you, go to Psalms. I mean, it'll just feed you. But anyway, so moving ahead, so we've dealt with my greatest desire, right? My greatest desire was this baby and to read books. Well, I've been reading a lot of books, but the baby thing was seemed to be kind of a joke. You know, like, ha, 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 I made you to really want babies, and now watch, you know. And maybe that's just really immature, but that's how I felt. But we are with my sister-in-law, who's a very godly woman. She's my age, but she's my spiritual mentor. And I remember telling her all of this. And I remember she looked at me and she said, "So I guess you really don't believe God." And I said, "Of course I believe God." And she goes, "You really don't." And it kind of was like, you know. And she goes, "You really don't." And I was like, "I think I do." And she said, "No, you don't believe God. Do you believe he's good?" And I said, "Well, I guess, yeah." And she said, "Do you believe he loves you?" And I said, "Well, you know, it says he loves me, but, you know, it's okay, but..." But I think it really pierced me in that I really didn't. And she said, "You have a crisis of belief." And she said, "You are going to have to choose to believe what the Bible says is true and not base it on what you're feeling." And that was an epiphany for me. And I didn't come to it that day and like walk home and be fine. But I think I really struggled with that over the months. I really didn't believe. I mean, I believed in Jesus. I believed in my own redemption. I believed all that. But I really, when it got hard, believe in God's goodness and that he loved me. That was my struggle. So fast forward to what I'm really supposed to be talking about, but I just wanted you to understand kind of my heart with God and how that struggle, in case any of you had. Fast forward to, we have adopted Lilia from Ukraine. She's been home about almost 2 years. And I go to a regular doctor's appointment, and we've, like I said, we've dealt with the biggest desire, and now we get to deal with the biggest fear. Because I remember sitting on that little scrunchy, scratchy paper that you get to sit on. Y'all know that real fun white paper that you're sitting on. And I remember the way it felt, and I remember looking up on the thing, and this woman surgeon is pointing at the wall, and she goes, well, yes, yeah. She walks in the room. She goes, yeah, you've got cancer, just like that. And she goes, here's the tumor, and she's, you know, showing me, like, the whole ultrasound mammogram stuff, and she's got, yeah, you've got it, and I can see the tumor, and, you know, it's probably, you know, we can get it out. It's probably not be it. And I remember feeling like she was in a tunnel really, really, really far away, and her voice was kind of coming at me like an echo, and I knew what she was saying, but I wasn't really there, and I felt like I was kind of floating around. It was just a really weird feeling. And what was good, I guess what the good thing is I didn't feel like God was against me. I was angry, and I was shocked. But I wasn't angry at God, really. I just was really confused about the timing of an orphan coming home, and then your mom has cancer. And I know I have a friend that y'all probably know that we just talked about that. It's like, really? You know, how far along is it? Is this going to be able to be arrested? Is this the end? She really doesn't have a mom again, really? And I remember that was my main confusing point. But it didn't feel like God was against me, even though I wasn't happy with it. And the struggle was hard, even though I had a lot of sweet friends around me, and that is probably a lot of what we want to tell you about just in a minute, is how to be there. But I think for me, facing the fear, I don't know if y'all might not need this, but for me, I needed to face that fear in order to fear God more, if that makes sense. I needed to look at death. I needed to think about death. I needed to really process death and cry about death and think about what it might be afterward. I needed to be a little bit eternally minded, a lot eternally minded. And I needed to go there, even though it was yuck, to be able to handle the rest of my life and to treat God fairly. And so I think for me, God needed to deal with my biggest desire and my biggest fear. And I think that's why I started with my childhood, because I think I was just so angry that he made me, and then he seemed to take away the very things he gave me. But I think it was all about him being my biggest desire and him, like I said, me fearing him more than cancer, which, you know, if they told me tomorrow I had it again, which, you know, you go all the time, I'd still be afraid, but I don't think he's against me. I think he's good. But
me?
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm going to start kind of at a different point, because I was fairly blessed. Oh, there's my guys. Bailey is in eighth grade, and then Luke is in fifth, and Emmy is in second, and Caleb's in pre-first. And then we have one more picture. You have a little bit that's coming, and that we're going to get her in like 2 months. So that's Lexi. I was one of those people. I mean, I suffered, and everybody goes through life, and you don't make this team, and you don't, you know, you don't get what you want, and people get sick. But I had made it to my 30s before I really had to wrestle with God's goodness when I didn't feel it, and my obvious lack of control of life. And, you know, I was very organized, and everything had a plan. I had a plan A, plan B, plan C, and he had to shake that up. And so I'm going to start kind of, we'll skip to my mid-30s. Bailey is our oldest, and when she was in fourth grade and 10, she began complaining about knee pain. And being the wonderfully sympathetic mother that I am, I ignored her. And, you know, I'm that mom that doesn't go to the pediatrician and doesn't, you know, I'm an athlete, suck it up, ice it, let's go. And my husband's the same way. So we ignored it for about 6 weeks. It continued. By the grace of God, my sister-in-law is a physical therapist, and she said, I don't like it. I think we need to have it looked at. So we went to the CHOA doc in the box one day, and we had already been there once for stitches for the little one, because that's how he rolls. And so we took her, got an x-ray. My husband brought her home, and I was peppering him with questions. And he's like, why don't you just take her? You always do this. And he didn't really have any answers. He said, well, they didn't know what it was. They said, you know, they saw something. But and it was, and that should have been my first clue. And I think I knew something was off because they did an x-ray. Why don't they know what it is? So that next Monday morning, I got a phone call from our pediatrician, and I will never forget where I was, what her voice sounded like. And she's normally very calm, and she, you could hear the terror. And she said, I don't know if I should tell you this over the phone. I don't know how to tell you this, but I think Bailey has a bone tumor. And that was the point. And so that's where I start this, is that everybody's had suffering and everybody's had stuff, but it's that stuff that defines your life. The, you know, our whole life now is defined before cancer and after cancer. And it was at that moment that everything changed. So that was, it was March 2012. That was Sunday. We went to the x-ray. On Tuesday, she had an MRI. On Thursday, she had a biopsy. And on Thursday afternoon, we had a diagnosis of osteosarcoma, which is a rare and aggressive form of bone cancer that mainly affects children. The thing with childhood cancer is they are extremely aggressive, and so they are treated differently than adult cancers, and you move fast. So, you know, on Thursday we had a diagnosis. That following Monday she had her port placed and started chemo. So you're in this place of your brain can't even keep up with what you're feeling, and wrestling with that, and I had never been there, and it was terrifying. And what do you do, and how do you get ready to be there, and that week, you know, we lovingly refer to it as Hell Week at our house, because it was just so fast and so hard and so many tears. And, you know, they tell you not to Google, but you Google, and you see all these horrible statistics, like 65% survival rates, and you just think, oh my gosh, my baby's gonna die. She's gonna die. And that, you know, as a mom, you worry about your kids, but you don't ever imagine a doctor sitting across from you going, she has a bone tumor. So that's where we were, and we started that process, and she was in treatment that week, and she had 10 weeks of chemotherapy. And I did back off the computer for a while and tried to just turn it over. But then what they told us is, well, the tumor's got to come out. It's got to come out because it's in her bone, and she's not going to live. It doesn't come out. Well, how do you get a tumor out of the bone? It's not good. So I got back on. We started doing research and stuff, because you have to be prepared and realize that getting the tumor out was as devastating as the cancer diagnosis, because she would never be the same. This was a kid who was a tomboy. All she wanted to do was play basketball. All she wanted to do was run and climb trees and wrestle with her brothers. And we're an active family. And everybody said, oh, you know, but it's just sports. But it's your life, right? Do you want to water ski? Do you want to jump on the trampoline? Do you want to mountain climb? And all of that was being threatened to be taken away from her. So, you know, we did our research. We found the three options. She could have kept her leg. Everybody said, oh, they do this great limb salvage now. It's awesome. You can keep your leg. Well, you can keep your leg and do nothing with it. They fill it. You know, you get a grandma knee replacement. You get a metal rod in your femur. And you have the restriction of never running again, never jumping again. More surgeries, possible infection and amputation. And these kids with these salvages are in and out of the hospital, in and out, in and out. And some of them don't walk for 2 years, and then they amputate anyway. So we were like, that's the good option. Next option was we could have just done a straight-all amputation. Great, you know, you can get great function. You can do a lot. Prosthetics are great. And then the final option was called a rotationplasty. And if you're not familiar with our story, you can Google that later. And that is essentially where they cut out her tumor was here. They cut out the healthy portion of your leg, or the unhealthy portion of your leg. Take the healthy portion, rotate it, reattach it. So you wear a prosthetic on the bottom, and your ankle becomes your new knee. It's fascinating, and it's amazing testament to God's parts just work better than any parts that we can make. But that was the best option for our child, was to disfigure her for the rest of her life so that she could run and play and jump. So as we were going through this treatment and going through this agony and walking her through it, you know, that's when I was wrestling. And I was wrestling with, where are you, God? Why? I mean, where are you? I can't feel you. I am watching this child throw up. I kept a tally for a while. She threw up over 100 times. You know, she was in the hospital 50% of between her fourth and fifth grade year, and she would just cry, and she'd miss important things, and she'd weep, and she'd look at me, and she'd say, "Mommy, am I always going to feel this bad after chemo?" And what do you do when your kids are sick, and you're a mama, and you can't fix it? And I think that's what broke me, and that's where God broke me, is how do I live in this, and what does my theology mean when I just can't feel God, and he's not there? And that has kind of been the theme, I think, now, is learning to trust and learning to trust in the truth that I know and the theology that I have when I'm angry and I'm mad and things don't get wrapped up in a pretty little bow. So back to her. So we presented the options to her, and she is wise beyond her years. And she said, "I want that one where they put my foot on backwards." So there she is there with two legs. And all I did for those weeks leading up was stare at her leg. And we had a little goodbye leg party, and we signed it. And I just kept staring at it. And I made the decision every night I would lay in bed, because Satan comes in at 3 a.m. And I would lay there, and I'd remake it. And I go, "There's got to be a better way. There's got to be a better way." And we'd come back to the same decision every time. So that is her before. And when they wheeled her away, it was the worst moment ever. And that is her after. And that is not a happy kid there. But like 2 days later, the smile was back. So she's kind of a miracle. And there is her learning to walk again for the first time. So after surgery, she got to go back and have 20 more weeks of chemotherapy, which was awesome. So skinny, so pale. They bring these kids to the brink of death. And then we were done with that part of the journey. Well, at least you think you're done, right? You're done, but you get to go back for scans every 3 months, and you get to worry about if it's coming back and if her heart's going to fail from the chemo and if she's going to be able to have babies and if her hearing is going to fail and if her kidneys are going to fail and all of this stuff. But the blessing was she had a good response to the tumor. Her tumor died. The chemo worked, and she's doing great. We thought that was the end, but then you jump into life and you realize that's not the end. There's a whole host of PTSD and depression and after to deal with, because you've been living on adrenaline and stress for so long, and when you can finally let down, you just, and you crash hard. And trying to re-enter in your life and go watch normal, healthy kids run when your 10-year-old is learning to walk again, and all of these things that just reveal your sin and your idols and your ugh, and there was just so much wrestling going on. So we did that, we'll talk a minute about, how it affected us specifically, but we had gotten sort of in a rhythm of a new normal, and we thought, okay, we've got this cancer thing. God brought us through that to minister to other families. There have been probably 15 new rotationplasties in Atlanta now, partly because Bailey has gotten the word out that it is not so scary, and it's by far the best function. I had 15 families at our house this summer for a pool party. All these backwards feet. There were legs everywhere. And you just kind of go, okay, all right, that's awesome. There's legs all around our pool. And they're all hopping because they hop. They take off their legs and they hop and the foot's backwards. And it really does look as weird as you can Google it later. So through that. And then we get the news that Bailey's best friend, Kylie, has cancer. And there's sweet Kylie there. And so let me backtrack. Kylie was one of two girls that never left Bailey's side when she was sick in the fourth grade. They were soul sisters. There is a deep connection there. And she would push the wheelchair. She would come to the hospital. I can remember sitting at the hospital with Kylie's dad, and they were playing skip-bo. And, it just couldn't be. And when Kylie was having these symptoms and stuff, we just kept saying, "No, God, no. This is not okay." And it turns out she did. She not only had cancer, but she had the same type of family of cancers that Bailey had, a solid tumor sarcoma. And that was just a point of, because here I thought we were through it and we found our purpose, and you're going to drag my kid through this again with her best friend? And it was just hard. And so unfortunately, and Bailey would go, and it connected them on a level that it was even deeper because they both knew, right? Because 13-year-old girls don't know what this is like. And so they had each other, and they didn't have to pretend that they were just happy and carefree. They could just be. Unfortunately, Kylie's cancer did not respond, and she was diagnosed almost 2 years to the day after Bailey in April of 2014. And it just kept getting worse and worse and worse and worse. And the worst part was that Bailey knew it was getting worse and worse because she knows, oh my gosh, it's in her lungs. I mean, Bailey knew everything. And so on February 12th, in February of that year, it looked like Kylie was not going to make it. And on February 12th, Kylie's daddy called me and he said, it's getting close and she wants Bailey to come. So I checked her out of school. We drove to Kylie's house. And I watched my 13-year-old sit by her bedside and say goodbye to her best friend. And, I mean, that was as hard as any of the cancer stuff we walked through because I felt like Bailey had been through so much, so much, and she was just starting to reclaim a piece of her childhood. And now it was gone forever. There was no childhood left. So instead, they looked like two little old ladies in the home saying goodbye, and Bailey was sitting there holding her hand. And that was the last time we saw her alive. And, you know, and I held Robin as she wept, and we were broken, and we left, and Kylie died. We never saw her alive again. And that was last spring. And so, you know, I thought that I had worked through all this with God and wrestled through it and gotten to a place of peace, and that shattered all of us. It shattered my husband. I mean, Bailey was, she ached for this girl. And so that's where we were, and the spring was ugly. We were sad, and I would sit down to do quiet time, and I would have nothing. I would just have nothing. But I guess the blessing is that I knew that that was okay. At that point, I had grown at least enough to know that I could have nothing, and I could doubt, and I could be angry, and that was all okay. He was big enough for that. And we're still, I mean, Bailey is still grieving, and it's the sweetest, saddest thing. Whenever we see the Myers, you know, she hugs Kylie's mama and they both weep. And then my heart breaks all over again. And it's just, it's awful. And I don't understand. And this is one thing that I will not understand, the side of heaven, how both of these two girls in this small class in this small Christian school could have the same kinds of cancers and one dies and one doesn't. And it's just, horrible. So fast forward to current. Bailey just had her 3-year scans and she is cancer free. And we get to go from 3-month scans to 6-month scans now, which is very exciting because when you do those scans, they age you like 5 years every time because you sit there and you try to read them. And Patrick says, you can't read scans. You're not a doctor. Stop. And so we, you know, and you wait for the doctor to come in and he comes in and he wants to chit chat and you don't want to chit chat. You just want to know, are they clear? Are they not clear? And then we can chit chat. So it's 6 months and that's great. And so that's where we are. And we'll talk in a minute about finding the joy in it, but it is. And so what we're wrestling with and settling in on is life is hard. It is just hard. And I didn't know that before. And now it's hard. And how do you live in that? And how do you find joy in that? And it, the both and, right? The suffering and the joy together. And so that's where we are now. And it is not a neat little package. She is still an amputee and that leg is not coming back. And we got other kids with other issues. That can be another talk. Because my middle two have anaphylactic food allergies, which is a joy. And the little one is adopted, so that's a joy, too. And we're adopting another one, so I'll just, you know, so I'll be back.
I love that middle.
You have a question sheet on your table. If y'all could just take a few minutes and read the questions, question set one. And just take a few minutes, just 2 or 3 minutes, and talk amongst yourselves. Donna and Laurie, that'll be fun, right? Just the two of y'all. All right. Tiffany and I are just going to share just a few verses that have meant a lot to us through different times. And I'm not going to bore y'all with more of what exactly was going on when a lot of this was happening. But I will tell you that in the process of infertility, I lost a baby. And this was a verse that at that point meant a lot to me. And it has continued to mean a lot to me through everything, chemo, all of it. It's, but you, O Lord, are a shield about me, my glory, and the lifter of my head. And the part of that that really ministers to me still and ministered to me then was the lifter of my head, because I don't know if you would agree with me, but I physically understood what that meant in the sense, not that I was so weak, not chemo, but back when it first happened, I was so down after I lost the baby that my head was really down all the time. And so I remember reading that and going, he is the lifter of my head. He is the lifter of my head. He is the lifter of my head. And that one meant a lot to me. And I'll share one more and then Tiffany, you can. Yes. Oh, I'm so sorry. It's Psalm 3:3. Psalm. Yeah, yeah. And then the other one, this is not going to make any sense, but it's the horse is made ready for the day of battle, but the victory rests with the Lord. And that just took a lot off of me in a lot of these different situations that I was going through when with Neely and with my own cancer, was that victory rests with the Lord. Either way, victory rests with the Lord. Whether you die, whether you live, victory rests with the Lord. And all I'm really doing is making the horse ready for battle just to be obedient. But I really have nothing to do with whether there's a victory or not. And I know that sounds depressing, but it wasn't to me somehow. That was affirming to me and encouraging to me in the moment. And Psalm 139 also is something that I know y'all all know Psalm 139 through, you know, he created me in my mother's womb, all that. But that's not the part that I love. The part that I love is most definitely the beginning. And that's, oh, Lord, you have searched me and you know me. You know when I sit and you know when I rise. You perceive my thoughts from afar. You discern my going out. I mean, just think about that a minute. He knows when you go on an errand. You discern my going out and my lying down, which I like to do on the sofa. I love that he knows when I'm doing that. You are familiar with all of my ways. Before a word is on my tongue, you know it completely, O Lord. You hem me in behind and before. And when you're going through something where you're facing death a lot, you hem me in behind and before. It's pretty awesome. You have laid your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me, too lofty for me to attain. Where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? If I go up to the heavens, you are there. If I make my bed in the depths, you are there. If I rise on the wings of the dawn, if I settle on the far side of the sea, even there your hand will guide me. Your right hand will hold me fast. If I say, surely the darkness will hide me and the light become night around me, even the darkness will not be dark to you. The night will shine like the day, for darkness is as light to you. And then it goes to the part that we all know about being in your mother's womb. But that part to me, just that he cared that intimately about when I sat and when I got up, just floors me. And the last one I'll share is Psalm 91 was another one that still to this day is just gets me through the day on a day of hope, you know, a day you're scared, a day you have a new pain, a day you whatever. It's one that has ministered to me greatly. And I could tell you weird things that happened during chemo and after surgery and a lot of different times that I know that God sent. I know that God used his creation to minister to my heart on days that I was super scared or super sick, because there was probably five different occasions when God sent clouds to cover me. And I know that sounds strange to you, but he did. One time I was sitting on the beach, and it was a weekend before I was going to go in, and I was going to have the surgery. I had a double mastectomy, and we were going in, and my husband was at this point kind of grieving. And I know that sounds really strange, but not just the cancer. He was really grieving the surgery because he thought it was going to all get better. And he really believed that we were going to pray and it was going to get better. And for him, it was a grieving process, that surgery was, and I never really got that. But it was. And we were sitting on the beach, and it was sunny everywhere, and it was beautifully sunny, and this tiny little cloud came and parked right over our umbrella. Not even the umbrella next to us had the cloud. And I love rain, and everybody who knows me that I love rain. And when it would be a particularly hard day, or we got news that I wasn't expecting, you know, like I didn't think I was going to have chemo. I thought it was just in my breast and it had spread a little bit, my lymph nodes. And so just things like that happened. I always had rain or I always had a cloud covering me. And this means a lot to me. And I could tell you other weird things about the cloud and wind. But he who dwells in the shelter of the Most High will rest in the shadow of the Almighty. I will say of the Lord, he is my refuge and my fortress, my God in whom I trust. Surely he will save you from the fowler's snare and from the deadly pestilence. He will cover you with his feathers, and under his wings you will find refuge. His faithfulness will be your shield and rampart. You will not fear the terror of night, nor the arrow that flies by day, nor the pestilence that stalks in the darkness, nor the plague that destroys at midday. 1,000 may fall at your side, 10,000 at your right hand, but it will not come near you. You will only observe with your eyes and see the punishment of the wicked. If you make the Most High your dwelling, even the Lord who is my refuge, then no harm will befall you, no disaster will come near your tent, for he will command his angels concerning you to guard you in all your ways. And obviously, when this was meaning a lot to me at different times, I had no guarantee that things would go the way that I wanted them. I'd learned by now that I wasn't in charge of telling God what to do. But this really ministered to me, and I always felt like, and I still do, I'm the person that giggles at the forum when a cloud comes over, and I do to this day. I just start laughing because, to me, I feel like I'm under the shelter of his wing, and it is such a physical thing for me, and it is such a beautiful reminder to me of being under his shelter and the fact that he's just holding me there under his wing no matter what's going on, no matter if it's a good day or a bad day, that I'm there. That's really where we are, and that's the ones that probably meant the most to me, but Psalms, love me some Psalms.
Yeah, it's, you know, there were so many, and there in the beginning, I think after something like that happens, you have a point where there were no verses coming to me. I didn't even know sort of how to get to a point where I was communicating with God. But then it was sort of part of the grieving process, I think, where eventually when you begin to accept what's happening and just forcing yourself to spend time in the Word, he starts to show you some recurring themes. You know, and one, all of mine sort of centered around suffering is what part of the deal, you know, and Bailey's verse that she had on her bracelets that we had made, James 1, 2 through 4, which is the one you always hear, but consider it pure joy, my brothers, whenever you face trials of many kinds, because you know the testing of your faith develops perseverance. Perseverance must finish its work so that you may be mature and complete and not lacking in anything. We clung to that because there were so many times when it did not feel good. And we just had to trust that this was God's plan for us, because you just couldn't make sense of it. There are just so many. 2 Corinthians 4, 8 through 9, we are afflicted in every way, but not crushed, perplexed, but not driven to despair, persecuted, but not forsaken, struck down, but not destroyed. And it was amazing, and I look back now, and that's the one that stands out to me, because even after all that we've walked through, I've got this child that's full of joy and hope. And our family, we cry a lot, but we laugh a lot too. And I look back and I think, how did we do it? I don't know how we did that. And we did, because his grace was enough, and it was given to us as we needed it, when we needed it, not a second before. I think
that's something that you and I really talked about a lot when we were talking earlier, is how even now that we'll hear of something happening to someone else, do y'all know what I mean? You'll hear of it happening to someone else and you'll go, oh my gosh, could not handle that. And it's like when you're in the middle of the thing, even if it's the thing you fear the most, your child, something happened to your child, or for me, you know, cancer, you know, even if it's that, I mean, help me, you know, I mean, what? You don't know where I'm going, do you?
Keep going, and then I get something to add to the end. I got the back end piece of that.
The back end piece of that. I don't know. I just guess that. I don't know. I don't know. I honestly don't know where I was going.
Well, you just so I read because that was how I was going to make sense of what was happening to me. Not the Bible, other things. But I read, somebody said that your suffering is carved out for a very specific shaped hole in your heart. And so you can't look at someone else's and say, oh, I could never do that, because you could if that's what God called you to and that's what he was going to fill you up for.
Yeah, and just that he kind of gives you what you need when you need it. Not that it's fun then, but you are given the ability to bear what you need to bear that moment.
And also just a helpful tip, don't say that to somebody going through stuff. I could never do that because they might punch you in the face. I mean, because nobody asks, right? God doesn't say, hey, I think I'm going to send this. Are you ready for it? I mean, it just comes. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So what we were going to do is there were some themes that sort of came out of both of our stories that we felt were common. And so we were just going to touch on those. And then we have some more table talk, you know, things, marriage, how to walk your kids through the hard, that kind of stuff. So we'll just take them one by one.
I think we're going to start with marriage.
Yeah.
And you were going to start that.
I was going to start that.
You were.
Okay. So marriage, you know, one thing we were so scared of when we got the diagnosis is you hear of all these families crumbling when they go through crisis. And when we were in the cancer community, you could see it. I mean, the divorces and the stress is so great, and there's financial stress, and there's, you know, he's pulling one way and you're pulling one way. And we were so afraid of that. And so I think the Holy Spirit, I don't know how we knew to do this, but immediately we called a counselor. And we're with her probably that next week. And Patrick was already worried about me because he felt like I wasn't grieving right. You know, I wasn't doing it like he was doing it. And so he was worried that I was going to have some sort of breakdown. And she said, no, you know, men and women are different. And there's the book about the waffles and the spaghetti. And it really is true. You know, men are waffles and women are spaghetti. And so he could shove it in the box, and because he had to go to work, and he had to do all of those, he had to carry us on his back, whereas women, it's all touching. And so I was a mess all day long. And once she said, that's okay, you're different, that was the freedom. And from that point on, I don't think we had an issue because we allowed each other to be
But you and
different.
I both talked about how after it seemed to settle a little bit, mm-hmm. that's when the men fall
yeah.
apart. Yeah.
I think because they're waffles.
Like, yeah. Those yeah. waffles fall apart.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. well, you know, you live on adrenaline for so long, yeah. and he puts the whole
and
family
they're solving the
back,
problems.
And he's
and
solving the problems
making
and making the decisions and going to work. And then that you're living on those stress hormones. And then you finally let down and just phew,
and you're ready for life to be normal. And that's yeah. when they fall apart. And so yeah. you need to still go to counseling.
Yeah.
After
yeah.
that.
And you know, Patrick would not mind me sharing, but he had a year of depression following mm-hmm. The illness, because he had been so strong and he just fell apart.
Yeah.
His body couldn't do it anymore. Whereas I was like, hey, let's go. Mm-hmm. We're out of the hospital. Cause I had been grieving the whole time mm-hmm. because I was the one there at night, you know, holding the bucket.
So I think that's something that you had said that you really wanted to just emphasize was how people in the Christian community sometimes don't want to pursue counseling, but that was something that you viewed as so positive.
Imperative.
And I said, we never
yeah.
could afford it, so we didn't do it, but we
yeah.
still need it.
Yeah.
So, you know, I agree yeah. with her, but, you
yeah.
know, absolutely. And for me, I don't know, there's so many women I feel like now that are dealing with specifically breast cancer in its different stages and forms that I would say, and I've talked to many people, and I know that this is true for probably over half, but not all, but maybe it speaks to my vanity. But for me, I will tell y'all that intimacy is a big issue. And I tell you that in the way that, I mean, I would love it. Everybody you know that's had breast cancer and has had this surgery and gone through it and has taken the medications that you take afterward for a long time would love for you to pray for their marriage and for that aspect of it, because it is very difficult. I told Tiffany, I felt like that weird movie that my friend made me watch where the man fell in love with the plastic doll that he carried around in his seat, in the seat next to him. That's what I felt like for a really long time, and I still do often. I feel like I'm kind of the plastic version of woman, and, you know, that couldn't possibly be desirable. Or, you know, because it's not like I went and got, you know, augmented. I have no feeling. I could run into a wall and you can't feel it. They're completely numb. So they look good in clothes, but they're basically just stuck on there. And there's nothing. I mean, I hate to tell y'all this, but this is just the way it is. So, I mean, there's just nothing. So I would tell y'all, if you have friends going through it, that's hard. And it's hard for the marriage, and it's hard for me to know how to deal with him in that. It's hard for me to know how to deal with that. Is that vanity? Is that, you know, where's the sin in that? But it's weird, and it's hard, and it's not hard like I'm going to die, maybe hard, but it's just a marriage. It's a point in the marriage that is difficult for people. So I think if you have someone close to you, which we all will at some point, I would say be sensitive to that if they're really close to you, and let them talk about it. Because I don't have a lot of people that I talk about that really deeply, but I do have a few people. And it's kind of nice because it's awkward to talk to my husband about it. For some reason, I just don't want to tell him. It's like it's almost like I want to keep it like a facade, like I still think everything's all nice and good, you know, even though it's weird. But, you know, so I would say that's something. But and also I'd say that you and I both agree that if you're not leaning on God first, mm-hmm. not just the husband, that it'll all fall apart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, somebody told me early on that you cannot, when you are in that kind of suffering where you are struggling to breathe, and to just get out of bed every day, you cannot rely on your spouse to pick you up. You can't, and you have to go to Jesus, because they are trying to keep themselves afloat. They cannot keep you afloat too. And you think it should be this beautiful, like, oh, we're going to do this together, but you just don't have the strength.
You're surviving.
And that's okay. Mm-hmm. And somebody told me that early on, and that was freeing too.
Yeah, I think so too. The next thing we were going to talk about is parenting through this.
Do you want to do these?
And that's, which ones?
The questions.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. Y'all have some marriage questions. Cue that music up. Go to question set two. Mm-hmm. Okay. We were just going to bring up just a few topics on parenting your kids through some hard times, either whether it's directly related to your family or someone close to you. And I obviously will take it more in the sense of a parent is going through something that is scary, and she will obviously deal with it from the kid perspective. But I think we both started by agreeing that honesty is obviously the very, very, very best policy, and that the only real discussion is how much you tell them based on their age. But to be as honest as you can be, if you need to come back and say, you know, it might be this way, it might be that, if you need to fudge a little just to let a little bitty handle it, but that we both feel exactly the same, that we always wondered if we weren't completely honest with the way things might turn out, that our children would not trust us in the future with things that might happen, that we just needed to be on that level. You know, this is the way it looks like it's happening, but this always could happen because this is the disease. But anyway, and I think we both agreed on that.
Yeah,
very
I think
much.
Obviously age-appropriate honesty is the thing to do, but kids are so smart and they're so perceptive, and if you are covering, they sense it. And you know, we would get pinned down by our 8-year-old, and he's inquisitive anyway, and would pepper us with questions, and he'd say, well, is she gonna die? We can't lie to him, and so we'd say, we don't know, we don't think so, but she might. And I don't know. You know, as a parent, you want to protect your kids and insulate them, but it's so important not to forget the great things that can come from them suffering a little bit. And it's so hard, and it's so hard to watch them hurt. But if not just the suffering, but the suffering and pointing them to Jesus while they're suffering. And so I think, yeah, just be honest. My fear was always, you know, I'm going to tell them it's going to be okay, and then it's not, and they're going to hate me forever. And so, yeah, just even with the little bitties, we were honest on an appropriate level, I think.
And I think, you know, we've heard people say, you know, you wouldn't really want to do that because they don't have any control over it. And I think, you know, at one point we were talking, we're like, well, we don't either. And that's kind of the point of a lot of what I've learned early on, was that I wasn't in control no matter what my scorecard looked like. And I kind of kept a scorecard of, you know, what good things I did and what bad things I did. And so I've already had one really bad thing, so I guess I'm good until I die, you know, until I'm 85 and die. You know, I guess I'm good now, you know, but that's just not the way it works. So I think to even teach your kids that we're not in control, but that God is good, no matter what, God is good, and he is in control, and we might not like what he does, but he loves us. And that might be hard to understand, but it's truth. And I think as soon as you can get that into your kid's brain, the better. Now, I have a Pollyanna husband who would never tell my kids anything bad. It's all happy, and you put cheerleader together with Pollyanna, and that's David. And, you know, so my kids thought I had, like, the flu for several weeks, you know, basically that same kind of thing, until it kept dragging on and on. I kept, you know, but so that's kind of him. So I would be the one. I didn't want to ever, like, go against his authority, but I'd come in the background and go, I think everything's going to be fine, but, you know, it's cancer. I think it, because I was the one that didn't want them to think it's all going to be fine for sure, you know. So anyway, yeah, I think that was probably the biggest thing, is just honesty and the fact that your kids are going to be, no matter how hard it is, your kids are just going to, the things you're going to see come out of you allowing them to enter into someone else's suffering, or to really understand the suffering that y'all are going through as a family, don't hide it all from them, because the things you will see will delight your very soul when you see it coming out. And you will just be like, I mean, you might not say, take me, Lord Jesus, because this was worth it, but I almost have, you know, just some of the things. I saw my son grow into a man in a week. and look at me and go, Mom, don't worry about schoolwork. I've got this, you know. And I saw my daughter quit the track team. She's horrible. She would never be a track star, but she liked to socialize. And she came in one day, and I was like, why are you home? She said, I quit. And I was like, well, I mean, she has a heart condition, like she's going to be, you know. But I'm still like, I know she likes to socialize. So I'm like, why? And she said, I need to be here. I need to take care of John Hunt and Lily. I need to be here. And I remember she went up the stairs, and I just started crying. And I wasn't crying because I was sad she was off the track team. I was crying because I saw her grow into a young woman who I needed that sometimes with her. So, you know, it was good. And then I had my little one who enters into everyone's suffering like Lori Jones does. And she would lay in bed with me and say this kind of thing. Only person. She would stroke me and go, it's okay if you die, Mama. I've heard heaven's really good. And she would do that. She's the one that was at the sink when the lady was washing my hair out, and I was not happy that day. That's the day you feel like a cancer patient. I'm sure if any of y'all have been through it, that's the day. Because you look like the poster then. You look like the after-school movie, the one where the mom dies and everybody's sad. That's what you look like when you look in the mirror. So that's not a good day. And my son sat in the corner. He's, what, 14? Sat in the corner way. Every now and then he'd turn the little salon chair around and kind of go, take a look. So I'd see him turn back around. But she has her hands in the sink, and she is rubbing the hair off of my scalp. She goes, you look beautiful. You look really pretty. And I was going, uh-huh. But, you know, but she enters the suffering. And I, you know, she kind of always was that way. But, a lot of growing up.
And it's hard. You sort of mourn that because the ignorance really is bliss, and you hate that they're kind of losing that childhood. But then you see some of the beautiful things that come out of it and the tenderness in their hearts. And, you know, I don't think it's a bad thing to learn early on that life is hard and people die. And so you need to do the best you can with your time here and use it for the kingdom, because you don't know the number of your days. And there's just great wisdom in that, even though you hate to lay such heavy stuff on your kids. I mean, we've seen stuff in our kids, and it's just precious, beautiful things. I mean, I have a 13-year-old daughter, and everybody complains about their 13-year-old daughters, and mine is like my favorite because she's so tender and so wise, and she wouldn't be that. You know, she'd be like every other kid had she not walked this hard road. So there's a lot of beauty that can come from it, even though it breaks your heart into pieces to watch your kids hurt. Mm-hmm. I think. Mm-hmm.
I agree.
Oh, and another thing, and we saw this a lot in the cancer world, is that your kids are going to feed off you, and you want to be, like, I found myself, I wanted to be fully authentic with them, but sometimes I felt like it was too much mess, and so I would sort of have to fake it till I made it a little bit, and then I'd go in the closet and fall apart, because they will feed off you. So if you are overly fearful, if you are the victim, if you are having the pity party, they will be too. And I think that applies to all of life. But and so sometimes I would just have to, you know, put my big girl panties on and go, okay, we're going to trust God with this. But on the inside, everything was screaming. But I knew that they needed that good theology in their heads too.
And I think that you and I both kind of agreed with each other with joy when we said that it was kind of good to learn that character is more important than happiness, you know, in your kid. Mm-hmm. And I think we all know that, but that's another one of those textbook knowledge versus see it knowledge. And mm-hmm. I think that's something we both hope we never lose, you mm-hmm. know, ever, is that character is more important than happiness in your kid. You mean you want your kid happy? I'm not saying let's all go home and be depressed, but you know, it truly is.
But we baby kids, I think, in this country, kids don't see the suffering that you would see in other countries, and they can handle so much more than you think. I mean, Bailey was 10 when she decided to amputate her leg, and she made that decision.
And she is joy filled.
Yeah. When you think of certainly a 10-year-old couldn't make that choice, but she'll say now it was absolutely the right choice, and God told her it was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, just a few minutes on question set 3, which goes with parenting. Am I jumping ahead of you?
No, you're
okay. Okay. And then we both also had that you are not in control, 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 you are not in control. That also went with parenting. So anyway, there you go. Yeah. Okay, just 2 more little things we wanted to talk about that were important to us. And one of them was, what joy have we taken away from the situations, and what would we not give back if we could? And I think both of us agreed number one, at least for me and high for Tiffany, was how to learn to live daily. And for me, it was, okay, like this thought, that you get in your car every morning and you turn the key and your car starts, right? Like 364 mornings a year. And then you get in your car one day and it doesn't start. And then you're mad and you're frustrated and you're annoyed. And nobody ever thinks about the 364 days that miracle of miracles, your car started. And that it really started to strike me, like when I was really in kind of, I think Lori would tell you, I was sort of in a fog during chemo. And I don't remember a lot of things. I told my son I like my daughter better. Yep. Don't remember it, but apparently it happened. That was Percocet, Laurie said. But apparently I did that. My husband gave me some diamond earrings I found last week, and I didn't remember them. And Lilia goes, yeah, those are the ones Daddy gave you for your birthday. I was like, really? Are they real? And she goes, yeah. And I was like, okay. And I went and asked him, I was like, did you give these to me? I have no memory of a whole lot. But just the joy in the moments of the day. Like, I remember when it hit me one night, and this started a little bit when we brought Lilia home from the orphanage, but I remember it hit me one night that the blankets that I pulled up over my children were super soft, and I couldn't believe it. I just remember it was almost like miraculous to me. I was like, why am I getting to pull this velvety soft blanket over my kid, and she is sleeping on two pillows and her sheets are washed and I didn't have to scrub them in a river. And I remember it just started overwhelming me, like these little details. And y'all probably all read that how many thousands of things you're supposed to write down on a list that you love thing. What is that book? Come on.
Thousand Gifts.
I read a third of it. I kind of got it in the first third. I'm a math person. I kind of got it in the first third. Couldn't even read the rest of the book. But it's a good concept, and it is definitely something that means a terribly lot to both of us. And we were talking about what's like the best thing in your week, sitting on the sofa together and you're all there. Mm-hmm. Is that not amazing that you're all there? You're all there. That's mm-hmm. amazing. Do you ever just sit there and go, this is crazy, I don't deserve this? You know, and just that whole just humility of, I don't deserve to still be here. I mean, I know people that were diagnosed after me that aren't. Mm-hmm. And I'll deserve to be here. I know for a fact one of them was better than I am. I mean, spiritually, way down the road. And so, I mean, to me, I know. I'm like, yeah, she was done. Yeah, I still got work. But anyway, so I'm just saying it really has meant a lot to us, just that the little things and that whole verse, you know, thy word is a lamp unto my feet, a light unto my path. And I know that y'all have all heard that it's for the next step, that, you know, it doesn't go down the path. It's just the next step. It's for your feet. It's right there in front of you, the path. And that's really all you're supposed to be worrying about. And I'm really not supposed to be worrying about the next scan, because the Lord might come back tomorrow and I've wasted all that time worrying about my scan. And I really don't have cancer the day of my scan. Because nobody's told me I have. You know, I don't have it right now. I mean, I might, but I don't know I have. So why am I living that way? You know, so for me, it's just been really a huge joy in every moment. And even the really yucky, I remember sitting at Outback when I had sores covering the inside of my mouth and I couldn't eat anything. Water tasted gross. And I remember sitting there and my kids were in such a funny mood. I have a funny son and we were in such a funny mood. They were all dying laughing and I was just dying laughing. I thought, this is the greatest night out. And I remember later it just struck me, I didn't eat anything, you know, and I really didn't feel good, but it was the greatest night out. And just the little things that were just supposed to be not looking forward to your trip to the beach, but it's about tonight when you get home and that your kid's on a pillow with a soft blanket. And there's lots of mothers in the world who dream of that and don't get it. Just, I don't know. There's just so many blessings that just pass us by when it's just all easy.
And I would agree with it. My favorite thing is just when we're all there together, because we spent an entire year not together, and I would be at the hospital and somebody else would be taking care of our kids. And it was just so sad because I felt like I was missing their lives. I was just missing their lives. And so now if we're home watching a movie on the couch, it's
awesome.
It's awesome. And I don't think it was awesome before. I mean, I think it was fun and yay, it was great, but I was always, you know, on to the next thing. And I think now I can stop and I just stop and I look at a sunset. you know, and I cry, and I'm not a crier. I'm an ISTJ, and I'm kind of like a man. And so I cry at things. I'll be driving in the car, and I just start weeping. And I think that's good. I mean, I think that's a good development. And another thing I would not get back is learning to live in the day. Because I was always on to the next thing, you know, when do we get the vacation? You know, when these kids are all potty trained, then I can be happy. When, you know, we have this house or whatever. And I was always on to the next step. And I'm not like that, I don't think, anymore. I'm very content to just be where I am and fight for the joy for that day and experience all that I can for that day. And I think that's new. That's post-cancer. That's new for me.
And that's a treasure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And then the last thing that we were going to share, are you ready to go on to that?
Yeah.
Okay. Was kind of how to be there for other people who might be going through something similar. And I should really just tell Lori to stand up and tell you what she did, because she basically took care of my family and my life for, you know, I don't know, 8 months, 9 months, something like that. But I will say that what was beautiful about that was that I never had to think up what needed to be done or direct. So I think what was really beautiful to me was seeing my family taken care of without me having to be the one coming up with it. In fact, when people asked me, what can I do? I always felt very panicked. I'd be like, oh my gosh, I don't know. I don't really even know what's not done. I don't even know if the kids went to school this week. So I really don't know what to tell this person. And now I'm stressed out. And it was just kind of like, I don't know, I don't know. So like the people that would just come along and just do without even asking, because they knew the laundry probably hadn't been done. So they'd do it. She did more laundry. But, you know, people just come do it. That was pretty awesome. That was like beautiful.
Yeah, I think community is, you know, I think about what can you do to be ready. I mean, you can't ever be ready for suffering. And what can you do to be ready for suffering? You're never ready for somebody to tell you your kid has cancer, but, you know, having good theology was one piece for me. We'd been at this church for 17 years and, I needed that truth because I didn't feel it, and it was there, and I knew it was there, but I did not feel it. And I think when you're in the middle of it, that's not the time to get your truth. But then the second piece of that, being prepared for suffering, is building community. I think you have to be invested and you have to have community, because when your world falls apart, that's who's going to carry you through. And, you know, we would be at the hospital and we would see people that didn't speak the language, that had no community, that had to travel to the hospital, and would be, their entire family would be sleeping on the floor of the hospital room. And meanwhile, I had a cooler outside our front door and I didn't cook dinner for 8 months, and we called it the magic box, and people would just, they'd leave food and the kids loved it. And I mean, we have food allergies, so you couldn't just make a dairy casserole and drop it off. Because then I'd have to stab somebody with the EpiPen. So, I mean, they would do that, and they'd bring these dairy-free, peanut-free meals, and for 8 months I didn't cook, you know, and just people taking my kids, and half the time I didn't even know who had my kids. Yeah, and so I would say, and the thing that goes with that is, don't ask somebody, don't say, what can I do, because they don't know. You're so numb, you don't know. I didn't even know what I needed. I just needed people to do things. You know, I had a sweet friend who just dropped off bread every week. We called it Bailey bread. And she'd drop it off, our Bailey bread. And she just would, she'd text me and she'd say, hey, there's warm bread on your front door. And
Sherry Harrell did that for
John. And I didn't even know we needed bread. But it was so nice. It was just so sweet and thoughtful. And sweet little texts like, hey, I'm thinking about you, praying for you, that kind of stuff.
What were you saying to me about theology that sometimes hurt?
There were sometimes people would send verses and things. I guess I would just caution you, be careful about that.
And you were also saying that they would sometimes say things that, because you knew theology, you knew that it wasn't correct theology, but it would.
Well, we got a lot
so
of.
So you would have to kind of put a barrier.
My favorite was God is good. And Bailey would get. She'd get a good scan result, and I'd get all these, God is good, God is good. And I think,
God is good anyway.
But would he still be good if she'd gotten the bad result? Then I'd start picking apart people's theology. And it sort of almost was like salt in the wound, because, you know, he's good regardless of if she lives or dies or has a good scan or bad scan.
And I think when you're in the moment, you are working to let that be okay in you. Not that it's okay, but you're working so hard to let life and death be in front of you because they are.
Yeah.
And so then when it's okay, the scan's good, so God is good, then you're like, okay, what does happen to me? If this is, what are you going to think if the scan's bad? And
so yeah, I think rather than giving people, I don't want to say don't give verses because that's bad. Rather than giving theology, just bake them bread. Like, really, I mean, that's better. That says, you know, do their laundry.
But you said Gene McConaughey could say anything.
You know, people like Gene McConaughey who spend their life suffering could say anything to me, and I would just weep. So I think it depends on the source, probably.
That's true.
Just do. Find a need and meet it and do it.
And also, if you can't find a need or you don't have time for a need, like the people that were just there and didn't demand conversation or anything, but just their presence spoke volumes sometimes just in this person knows this is hard and they care that it's hard. Mm-hmm. And they're not really trying to be everything. They're just there. That really spoke volumes too.
Just being comfortable being there.
Yeah.
In the mess.
Exactly.
And the other thing I would say is that for me, and everybody's story is different, but I think re-entry into life in the after when you're finding your new norm is very hard for so many people. And depending on if your child dies or if, you know, I don't know, a divorce or the husband strays or any of these things, to go and be around normal, happy people. I can remember pushing Bailey in her wheelchair and watching all of her friends who looked just like she did 2 weeks before run by. It was really hard to be normal. And then a mom would come up and say, oh, you know, carpool line was so long today and I couldn't get to tennis. And he'd be like, ooh. So just that the reentry is hard, whatever suffering you're going through. And just be gentle if you have a friend. You know, especially if they've lost someone, they're never going to come back the way they were. So it's best just to love them where they are.
Like protective? Like, are you still protective because you don't want to re-enter those emotions? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah.
I don't know. I think that we might have different viewpoints given the differences we've been through. Because, like I said, to me, nothing trumps that something happened to your kid. It just doesn't. But and I guess, I mean, I thought about things happening to my kid because they might not have a mother if it did not, but it's just still different. I work with middle schoolers all day long, and I did work with high schoolers, and that is my passion. And for a middle schooler, like, it's a really big deal that, like, they couldn't find the right shoes in the morning and that so-and-so said those weren't the right kind of shoes with that skirt. And they're really brokenhearted. So, I mean, I kind of have to go there like all day long. And they really are brokenhearted about it. Like, it's not a fake. You know, it's devastating. And if there's a breakup, oh, you know, counseling. So, you know, so I have to go there all the time, you know, where, but to me, if it was somebody whose marriage is breaking up, that's just as hard anyway. I mean, that's horrible. That's a death in its own. You know, but I understand what you're saying. So I don't know. I think I have to go down all the time, and it doesn't bother me. But I think you've come from a different perspective.
It doesn't. So it's funny because we get a lot of people coming to us. I guess we're safe now, and so people tell me all kinds of things. And sometimes I'm like, why are you telling me this? But I don't mind because we're safe. But I feel like everybody prefaces everything with, I know this is not as bad as yours, but, and then they tell me there's, and I hate that because we're not supposed to compare the suffering. So I do struggle a little bit if somebody is complaining about something ridiculous, because it, you know, it's hard because there is so much real hurt.
Pain,
and real serious pain. But I try to have a lot of grace for the fact that we're all supposed to suffer differently. And so, you know, what is painful for me might be not someone else's story. And we're not really supposed to compare. Well, yours is worse than mine and yours is way worse. So we can't. So, I mean, there's a lot of grace for that, I think.
I don't know if that answered your question. Okay.
Thank you guys so much for sharing tonight.
Thank you.